Good evening. I'm Charles Berry, the chairman of the board of the New York Society Library, and I'm delighted to welcome you this evening and glad to introduce Lawrence Burgreen, who will be speaking on his highly acclaimed new biography of Christopher Columbus. Larry is well known to many of us, not only through his writings, but also his involvement as a member of the board of the Society Library, for which we are particularly grateful. He is also a discerning user of our wonderful collection and facilities. Mr. Burgreen is an accomplished biographer and historian who has made his mark on the literature of exploration as vividly as many of his subjects have on the globe. In fact, his thorough research has taken him around the world to study the original source materials of his well-traveled subjects. He has written scholarly and engrossing accounts of the voyages of Marco Polo and Magellan, as well as an account of NASA's exploration of Mars. He has also written biographies of Irving Berlin and Louis Armstrong. Larry's latest book, on the man credited with discovering America, the man who gave his name to so many locations and institutions and landmarks in this country, provides insight into the great Columbus that would surprise many of our grade school scholars who were raised on the Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria. As with so much in history, the truth is often quite different from the myth. We are delighted to have Lawrence Burgreen with us tonight to dispel some of the myths and give us some of the gritty detail of how a remarkably brave explorer also had his human flaws. Larry?
Thank you very much. Thank you, Charlie, for that beautiful introduction, and thanks, everybody, for coming tonight. I'm very glad to see you here in so many friendly faces. It's really terrific, and even my mother's here, so I'm very pleased and proud about that, and I think I've been coming here actually to the Society Library ever since I was about 18. So for one project or another, and sometimes just to escape, and more recently for work and my duties as a trustee. So I'm really delighted to be here tonight to talk a little bit about the Columbus book, which was just published by Viking a month ago, and has kept me fairly busy since then. Columbus, as you can imagine, is a highly controversial figure, and undertaking this book was a very daunting idea that I had put off for years. Some of you may be familiar with my book about Magellan, Over the Edge of the World, and when you start thinking about Magellan, let's see what happens here. I'm not going to go that. When you start thinking about Magellan, you start thinking about Columbus inevitably, because the two of them were so closely bound. They were just about 25 or 30 years apart, and Magellan corrected some of Columbus's main errors. But I put it off for so long because it was Columbus, and there's enough material about him to practically fill this library. I have a Columbus bibliography in my office at home. In Italian, it's about 800 pages long of works about Columbus, and it was published in 1990. That's a significant year because it was 2 years before the Columbus quincentenary in 1992, and the number probably, well, at least 25 or 30% more material was published in and around the 1992-1994 commemoration of Columbus's voyages. So it is an immense amount of material. It's also an immense amount of misinformation. And I found during the years that I was researching Columbus's voyages in the Caribbean and in Spain and in Portugal, and in various research libraries in up and down the East Coast, every nation has their own idea of who Columbus is and what he means, if anything. There is Columbus, the conqueror and the bringer of Christianity to the New World. There's Columbus, the genocidal monster. When I was in Portugal and in Brazil, I was given a stack of books, 12 or 14 books in Portuguese, showing Columbus's ancestral roots in Portugal. He doesn't really have any, but there are a number of books that will explain that. The same goes for Spain. About Columbus's Spanish roots. Now, I live in New York City, and I've been asked many a time over the years about Columbus. He's really Jewish, right? He's really Jewish. He's actually a converso, you know, forced to convert to Christianity because he sailed at the time of the Spanish Inquisition. Would it were true. It would make for an even more interesting story, but it's just not. But it's interesting that the myths have accreted to Columbus over a period of time. In fact, as you know, he was from Genoa. He was born there in 1451. There are hundreds of documents that have been published by the city of Genoa that attest to his commercial life, his birth, his father's and family's activities, their legal disputes. So the doings of the Columbus family, his father was a minor politician and tavern keeper, are well known and well documented to the Genoese. And Columbus was very much a product of Genoa, which had an incubator of, not explorers and commercial mariners who were very rapacious. When Columbus was young, he sailed to Greece and he sailed to England. He sailed even as far north as Iceland, like other mariners from Genoa, on commercial missions, often very frustrating. They're poorly documented. We don't know much about them, but they gave him a long and strenuous apprenticeship. So when he began to plan a much more ambitious voyage, which I'll be talking with you about, at least he had some background as a mariner and a skill set. Now, it was practical knowledge. I'm going to talk about how Columbus emerged into a world-class mystic as these voyages went on during the 12 years. But his knowledge of practical navigation was peerless. And I think perhaps the proof of the pudding is the fact that he almost never lost a man on the water with any of these voyages. On land was a different matter. He was singularly inept as a commander, although he was often forced to be a leader of the Spanish colony in the New World and the Dominican Republic for years on end. And the sort of dark side of Columbus, the nefarious Columbus, the one that we have come to loathe in some ways, that emerged when he was on land. It can only be said in his favor that nobody else from Spain for whom he sailed had a better idea of how to do it and could do it any differently than Columbus did. I'm going to show you some pictures, and then at the end, if you have any comments or questions, I have a feeling they may be perhaps at least as interesting, maybe more interesting than my remarks, so I'd love to hear them. You know, Columbus is a many-sided figure and always a source of a lot of opinions. One of the things I hope that you'll take away is the sense that he was always considered controversial right from the beginning and always had his enemies, and there was rarely a time in most countries, France being a notable exception, where Columbus was ever revered or lionized or idolized in any way, probably because France didn't have any direct experience with him. And just before I begin, I've been asked a number of times, how did I research a book like this, given all this source material? And a lot of it was separating out what's the genuine material about Columbus from the masses of superfluous or bogus or highly speculative material. And I essentially relied on, like many other biographers, primary sources. In Columbus's case, they're abundant. Those of you who are familiar with my Magellan book, Over the Edge of the World, realize there's not much Magellan in it. We have almost nothing in his own words about what Magellan was like or seeing things through his own eyes. And with Columbus, it's very different. He was a torrent. He poured forth a torrent of words in his diaries, in his logs. Some of them were lost, but they were transcribed before they were lost. Some of them have been preserved. He brought along his teenage son, Ferdinand, on the fourth voyage, which I'll tell you about, which was an idol that turned into a nightmare. Ferdinand wrote very movingly about that voyage and what it was like to be stranded with his father, the Admiral of the Ocean Sea. And he later wrote the first biography of Columbus, which all later biographers, whether they admit it or not, lean on because Ferdinand was closest to the source. There were also people who participated in the voyages who had very caustic things to say about Columbus, often at great length, particularly Bartolomé de las Casas. If some of you have been reading the book, you're familiar with him. He was a sailor turned monk who lived to 90, served in the New World for decades after Columbus died, and tried to undo the harm that he felt that Columbus did not only to the Indians there, and I'm going to call the Taino the Indians for shorthand, the Taino people, but also to the reputation of Christianity, because Las Casas felt that Columbus was sort of the worst advertisement for Christianity he could imagine, with his cruelty, his unintentional violence, sometimes intentional, his callousness, and the message that he brought, which was the opposite of the way that Las Casas and a number of other people wished it were. So Columbus's, the meaning of Columbus's voyages have long been contested, and they probably always will be. Fortunately, we're lucky to really see what happened almost day by day or week by week on these voyages and what it was like to sail with Columbus. And just one thought I wanted to start out with before we get into all the difficulties and complications. And I came away with a sense of this book of what a very complicated person he was, almost Shakespearean in the contradictions that one can find in him. There were moments of great compassion, visionary insight, meticulousness, brilliant navigating, combined with unbelievably brutal insensitivity, visions that seemed to come out of nowhere that were just, they sounded delirious, if not psychotic. I'll talk about how he thought he was sailing uphill and discovered the entrance to Jerusalem. In addition to the complexity of his own personality, I want to talk about his personal courage and the difficulty of the task that he set himself. There were rumors of a shortcut to Asia. After all, he was going to Asia. There was no sense of a new world. He wasn't trying to discover any new world. He was just trying to get to an even older world, the one that Marco Polo had written about in his voyages. And he was the first one to do this. Other people had left on voyages looking for something out there in the Atlantic Ocean. Nobody returned until Columbus's first voyage. There were rumors about all sorts of voyages, and there were rumors that other people had gotten to the New World before Columbus, the Vikings, the Chinese, or somebody else, but they didn't leave, they left little or no trace of their voyages. They didn't change anything. Columbus, for better and worse, happened to stand at a fulcrum of history, and his voyages changed everything. After his voyages, the old world, the new world, were never separate. History, economy, natural history, flora and fauna, all kept flowing back and forth as a direct result of his voyages up until the present. In fact, you could make an argument that we live more now than ever before with the effects of his voyages. So Columbus had an impact, I think, that really would have astounded him, because he was going essentially for greed and glory. He wanted to get rich. He wanted gold. Ferdinand and Isabel, the king and queen of Spain, wanted gold, and that's why they sent him. Because he was also very devout, he wanted to convert as many of the people as he found to Christianity as a kind of good works. That was his sense of idealism. But he could never decide whether they ought to be converted to Christianity or become slaves. He actually writes about how he can't decide. At first, he thinks, oh, what ideal converts they would make. And the second thought, oh, they really should be slaves, because they would be so adept and so strong and so effective. Columbus is not a simple person. In some ways, he epitomizes all the contradictory impulses of his era, of the Renaissance and the Age of Discovery, but he also has his own unique spin on it. And anyway, the first voyage, which is where we'll start quickly, was the shortest, for my money, the least eventful. I mean, he did prove that his idea of sailing to somewhere across the ocean worked, although he was utterly mistaken about what he had done and where he had gone. But each voyage becomes wilder and wilder as he veers out of more and more out of control, and as the enterprise that he started becomes larger than anyone, including Ferdinand and Isabella back in Spain, ever imagined. So I'm going to see how this slide projector works. And this is in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It's a portrait. We think of Columbus, if not Columbus, someone like Columbus. There are actually little or no portraits, probably none, of him from life. So we the best we can do is rely on representations, often heroic or idolized. But here he is as a prosperous merchant of Genoa. Now, in real life, Columbus probably had red hair. As a young man, he was probably tall. He probably had blue eyes and very fair skin. None of these traits are apparent in this picture. Nonetheless, you know, it's often said to be Columbus. And Ferdinand and Isabella, who were looking for, as you can imagine, money to finance their kingdom. As you know, this was an arranged marriage. It was hardly a romantic match. Ferdinand had numerous affairs the entire time he was with Isabella. She was actually the leading partner of the marriage. They were unifying their two kingdoms to make a unified Spain under Castile and Isabella. And after she died, and she died a little before Ferdinand, he promptly married a 17-year-old who became his next queen. So sentimental they were not. Columbus's main champion was Isabella. Ferdinand paid some attention to the exploits, but it was Isabella who actually had a sense of what he might accomplish for Spain. She was deeply pious, which encouraged Columbus's pious gestures and approach to everything he did, to the point that he became joined the Franciscan order as a lay friar. He often wore a Franciscan habit, a brown habit, when he was ashore, partly to ward off criticism because it was more difficult to jail or try a clergyman. And he was even buried in his habit. Columbus. And when he came ashore between voyages, he stayed in monasteries. The other sailors usually went to brothels and taverns to enjoy themselves before they shipped out again on their next voyage. So Columbus lived a very austere life. Now, he had been married before the voyage briefly to a Portuguese woman. I think that's where some of this Portuguese connection comes in. We think she died young. She just kind of drops out of the story. They had a child, and then he had a longtime partner or companion, and although he'd sort of lost track of her as he kept exploring, and that's Ferdinand's mother. So Ferdinand, who in some ways becomes Columbus's most important successor, was his so-called natural son. These are romantic representations of ships heading out on his first voyage, and to give some sense of, you know, the vastness of the sea and his task that he faced. And keep in mind, there was no expectation that he would ever return from this voyage when he set out on the first one, and yet things happened much more quickly than he expected. He thought he was sailing all the way to China. And in 3.5 weeks, he reached the New World. Part of the reason why he was so confused was this book. This is his copy, Columbus's copy of Marco Polo's travels. And these notes in the margin are Columbus's marginal notes. And what he's done here, and you can give a sense of his thinking, you see he's drawn a ship, an Arab-style ship that impressed him. And he's also, throughout this, underlined items, almost like a shopping list, of things that he wanted to find in Asia. Remember, he thought he was sailing to Asia, not the New World, and he refused to acknowledge he had ever gone anywhere besides Asia. So he underlined things like spices and gold and various types of wood and slaves. And so those were the things that he was looking for, and this was a book which other mariners and navigators had. It was very popular in Europe, not always believed, but Columbus believed that he could do over water in a few months Marco Polo had taken years to accomplish over land. Of course, he did it so much more quickly that he was startled. When Columbus arrived in the New World, really, probably the island of San Salvador in the Caribbean, he expected to meet this man, Kublai Khan, who Marco Polo wrote about extensively, the emperor of the Mongols, the most powerful ruler on the face of the earth. And he thought he would establish trading relations with him. And it didn't stop to think that Marco Polo's account had been published 2 centuries earlier. Kublai Khan was long gone. And the Mongol Empire was in ruins. So I just want to give some sense of the kind of confusion on top of confusion that plagued Columbus, not just on the first voyage, but on all four of them. And you may say, well, how silly, how confused, but actually any European sailor would have thought the same thing. Columbus was expressing the conventional European view of where Asia or India or China, they're all roughly the same thing at that time, lay. And just to give some sense of what this was like, let's say you wanted to drive from New York City to L.A. Columbus, like Columbus trying to sail from Spain to China. And you know a few things. You've heard that when you get to a large body of water, you're in L.A. and if there are some mountains around, you must be in L.A. Well, he set out, and he got as far as Cleveland, say, if he were sailing. And he saw Lake Erie, and he decided that must be the Pacific Ocean. Now, even though it didn't fit Marco Polo's descriptions, he stubbornly clung to the idea that China must be around here somewhere, and nothing would deter him. So he wrote back after his first voyage an ecstatic letter to Ferdinand and Isabella describing all the wonders of China that he had found. Now, by this time, the pilots who had gone with him realized that something was amiss, that they were not in China, and that they were nowhere near China. After all, the people they discovered there, I'll be talking about them, the Taino, were very different from the Chinese. Marco Polo had brought along an interpreter who he thought could speak with them, but they were speaking their own tongue, Arawak, which was unintelligible to his interpreter. And he, with some difficulty, tried to learn the Indian language to communicate with them, but it was very, very difficult. What the Indians were saying, what Columbus thought he was hearing, were often two different things. So there was a tragicomedy of misunderstanding between the two sides. This is what he actually saw in the Caribbean, which is, if you've been there and you know how beautiful it is, it's pristine. This is probably his second or third landfall in the Caribbean on Long Island. And he described the azure water, he described the vegetation, and he didn't have names for what he saw growing there. He didn't have names for the animals they saw because they didn't exist in Spain. He didn't realize, of course, that he had gone to a continent that was existed since time immemorial on a separate evolutionary track. So he would say, well, there were some flowers that sort of looked like, and he would name a flower he had seen in Spain. He was looking for familiar animals, but there weren't any. He saw some creatures he called barkless dogs. Maybe they were gophers or something. But he didn't, it was very disturbing to him. And he said at some point he was so frustrated by his inability to name what he was seeing that he felt that he was on the verge of tears. So he was trying to keep a record of these delights that he was seeing. But at the same time, he was really baffled and couldn't understand what this was. Now, he had brought things with him. He had brought animals. He had brought plants. He had unintentionally brought germs. When at the end of his first voyage, he inadvertently brought things back to Spain with him, sometimes intentionally, sometimes inadvertently. This began what we now call the Columbian Exchange, which prospers or thrives to this day. There are dozens of items that he brought back and forth, but I'll just name two. One is a simple one, tomatoes. There were no tomatoes in Italy before Columbus. He brought back the first tomatoes. So he never had Mama Columbus's tomato sauce in Genoa because it didn't exist. And he brought with him, among many other things, horses, partly as beasts of burden and partly to scare any aggressive people that he might meet. And you'll say, oh, that's interesting that he brought horses. Horses changed the history of the New World. Eventually, the Indians took them over. They reproduced. They changed tribal life tremendously. It became stratified. Indians could roam much further. Nowadays, we can hardly think of the American Indian without horses. But before Columbus, there were none. They lived a much simpler life that was much more unidimensional, much more subsistence-level farming. Once they had horses, they could make war and become much more powerful. So without realizing it, Columbus's this one thing alone completely changed Indian life gradually over centuries, after his lifetime. What would Columbus's reaction have been? He would have shrugged his shoulders. Because he had tunnel vision. He was looking for gold, which he only found a little bit of, not much. He was looking for King Solomon's gold mines, which he had read about in Marco Polo or in the Bible. He sometimes conflated the two in his mind. Since he didn't find them that much gold, he wasn't as interested. And he was looking for Mongols or Chinese. So the Indians were of lesser interest to him. On his third voyage, he encountered the Maya, and you would say, well, how fascinating, the Maya. To Columbus, this was just a distraction. He had little or no interest in any of the indigenous peoples of South America or Central America. They were nuisances. At best, he felt that they were guides who could take him to Kublai Khan, who, of course, was long gone. Let's keep going. This is a view of some of the Caribbean islands from the air. And, you know, they give a sense of the spectacular colors that Columbus and his men saw there, the azure seas and the golden sands. And it was beautiful then, and it's beautiful now. Attempts have been made to retrace Columbus's route around the Caribbean because he visited dozens, maybe hundreds of islands. But over 500 years, the topography has changed because of the tides and storms. And also, Columbus didn't actually keep a very accurate measure record of his track because he didn't want people copying him. They did anyway. But he felt that if he found a huge trove of gold, he didn't want some competitor from Genoa or Spain or anywhere else getting there when he wasn't around. So he deliberately obfuscated some of his landfalls. So trying to retrace Columbus's route was a very tricky prospect at best. It was done most prominently by Samuel Eliot Morison in the book Admiral of the Ocean Sea, which was published in 1942. Some of you maybe are familiar with this tome, and his premise was to try and do that, but it was often a frustrating experiment. Nevertheless, it's regarded as one of the leading biographies of Columbus in English, at least until recently. Another book, which I found actually more interesting about Columbus, which came as a surprise, was a massive three-volume biography of him by Washington Irving, published in 1928, on which Morison relied rather heavily. And Irving didn't attempt to retrace his route. You know, he's better known for Legend of Sleepy Hollow, but he wrote this book towards the end of his life. It went through 140 editions very quickly, and it was by far his most popular work in his lifetime. And Columbus, in Washington Irving for Columbus, took records in Spain. He was a minister to Spain, went to the Archive of the Indies, which is a place where I did some research in Seville, and maybe some of you have visited there, and had them translate into English. And it was a similar method to the one I used, trying to recreate the voyages from the ground up, working from those primary sources, which he did. So in some ways, perhaps Irving is a more accurate, gives an accurate idea of what they were like. And you might think he would write about Columbus in rapturous terms because it was 1828 and a more naive term time, but not a bit of it. He was very aware of the cruelty that Columbus had sparked. Okay, the first voyage, there's a very simple map. There are much better maps in the book about it, but I wanted to give you a sense. This was a map that Columbus brought along, a map maker, which became a sore point with him. His name was Juan de la Cosa, and he realized not only were they not near China, but even more alarming to Columbus, this big landmass they were exploring, Cuba, was in fact an island. And the Indians who lived on Cuba said the same thing, that if Columbus went far enough west, they would see that it was, he and his men would see that it was an island. And you would say, well, so what? But to Columbus, this meant that his entire view of the shape of the world was wrong, because he insisted that Cuba was actually a promontory of China and a peninsula, and that he had reached it. If it was only a big island and there was more ocean beyond it, what lay even further west? Then he was confused. Now, neither Columbus nor anyone else in Europe at that time knew about the Pacific Ocean. This was not until Balboa came along some years later and first glimpsed it, and then Magellan traversed it in 1520, that the full extent of the Pacific was appreciated. It's the largest body of water on the planet. And it covers 9,000 miles. So Columbus's idea of the size of the Earth, the circumference of the Earth, was about 9 or 10,000 miles smaller than it actually is. That's part of the reason why he thought he was so close to China. If he knew how big it actually was, he might not have set out on this voyage, because it would have seemed too daunting. And even if he had, through some magic, managed to reach China, things might not have gone that well. A generation or two later, a cousin of his did sail all the way to China once the size of the Earth and shape of the Earth was better understood. This was not a voyage that was destined to change the course of history. He was taken into captivity by the Chinese, held for a time, and then released and sent back to Spain. It was a very ignominious end to a very ambitious voyage. If that had been Columbus's fate, we never would have heard of him, or he just would have been a footnote. So the fact that Columbus piled mistake onto mistake and kept going in the face of these mistakes and became more obstinate the more the evidence piled up the other way is what made his activities and his exploration so memorable and so resonant. I know it's a paradox. It makes no sense, the fact that he was so wrong, but that's why he was memorable. And that was something that I kept troubling me as I was working on this book over a course of several years. Not that Columbus was a modern person and that he was a great discoverer, but that he was a medieval person with a very religious and rigid mindset, who would not be swayed by mere facts, and gave primacy to his spiritual convictions. And that's what made Columbus Columbus. If he had been totally rational, he probably wouldn't have been as memorable. I mean, for an example, he had a brother, a smarter brother, named Bartholomew. Bartholomew was a map dealer and sailed with Columbus on at least two of the voyages, was regarded as by the men as very steady, steadier than Columbus, who was, you can imagine, was quite volatile. And his nickname was the Adelanto, not Columbus's nickname, Bartholomew's, the leader, the Adelantado, the leader. We barely remember him because he had all these stalwart, reliable qualities. And if I were sailing, I'd want to go with Bartholomew. I wouldn't want to go with Columbus. How about you? And because Columbus would get you into a tremendous amount of trouble. Yet he was savvy enough as a sailor to stay alive and to survive. But when he got far enough out, he became a fanatic, a zealot, and that was as trying for his shipmates and for his critics back in Spain as it was for anyone else. So let's keep going. Anyway, Lacoza drew a map afterwards showing that Cuba was an island. In doing this, he violated a blood oath that Columbus had made his crew sign. And he wanted all of his crew to swear that Cuba was part of the mainland of China. Even the ship's boys, the cabin boys who went along. And if they violated it, they would get 95 lashes. That was enough to kill a person. But Juan de la Cosa knew better, and within a few years, everybody back in Europe anyway was winking and saying, well, they really knew that something was awry with Columbus's conception of geography. The other thing that really puzzled him, and these are conceptions of what the Taino might have looked like to Columbus, at first he was very impressed by them because they were beautiful, they were dignified, they were very glad to see him. They regarded Columbus as a fulfillment of a messianic prophecy of theirs. We don't really understand it that well. But as some of his priests began to live with them, learned their language, and got some sense of their inner life and spiritual life, they realized that Columbus was in some ways a very deeply meaningful figure to these Indians. However, it didn't work out the way the Indians thought it would. They realized that Columbus wasn't leaving. According to their cosmography, this was supposed to be a visit. And Columbus, it seemed, came to stay. He left men at the end of the first voyage in a small fort. They were massacred, but then Columbus came back, and he came back three more times. And each time he did, he left more and more people, especially in the Dominican Republic, in what's now Santo Domingo, as the germ of a new colony, which grew and grew and grew. Santo Domingo is the oldest European city in the New World, founded in 1502. And if you go there today, you will see that it looks like a piece of Spain, of Renaissance Spain, which has somehow been magically transported to the Caribbean. And it's really a remarkable sense of displacement, if you will. And so the Taino gradually withdrew from Columbus, but they didn't become warlike, as you might think. He was afraid that they were going to slaughter him, but in fact, they weren't really aggressive. Their weapons were made of bamboo, and they were much more afraid of Columbus than he was of them, even though they outnumbered him by, well, we don't really know, but there were millions of Taino in the New World at that point, and just a handful of Columbus's men. But they were concerned that Columbus was occupying their sacred lands, confiscating them, taking them away. They wanted him to leave. Furthermore, Columbus's men were very quickly pairing off with the Taino, the Indian women, and having children with them. They considered them big prizes and to have, and some of them were coming on subsequent voyages to the New World for just that reason. For the Taino, this was deeply disturbing because they felt that their future was being tampered by this arrival of these outsiders. They were as sensitive to their bloodlines and their ancestry as anybody else would be. And now with this new development, they felt their land and their people, their future, were all being taken away from them. After a while, their reaction was not to try and kill all the Spaniards, but to kill themselves. They began jumping off of cliffs, because there are steep cliffs in the Dominican Republic. They began eating poison weeds, not just by the hundreds, and not just by the thousands. By Columbus's own estimate, 50,000 Indians committed suicide in protest at what we would now call the Spanish occupation of the Caribbean. Other people who were there at the same time mentioned the same number. And it was an event like such as this which outraged Las Casas and others, saw it as their role to bear witness to this deed. Now, when Columbus set forth from Spain with the blessing of Ferdinand Isabella, he had no idea that he would trigger a reaction like this. Ferdinand Isabella had specifically warned him to treat the Indians or any people he found in the New World in a kindly fashion, not to be cruel to them. We have it in writing. Of course, he violated that order, but even worse than that, you know, he triggered a reaction which was appalling. When he was aware of it, his reaction, his own response to it was a bewildered shrug of the shoulders. He didn't understand why, he didn't want to know why, and he didn't know what to make of it. And the other Spaniards who went with him were not enlightened ethnographers or anthropologists. They were in search of gold, or they were in search of thrills, and they really didn't much care. They were sort of proto-pirates, if you will. Nevertheless, these voyages then began to alter the complexion of Indian life in the New World for all time. Today, the Taino are virtually extinct. There may be a few around, and there's been an effort, especially in New York, to revive Taino culture and gain an enhanced appreciation of what it was, but there are really no Taino around to celebrate it or embody it. A couple of things that have survived to this day are Taino musical instruments like drums, which Columbus's men heard throughout the forest, and a game very similar to baseball. This was the first time Europeans had seen anything like it. But the center of Taino life, it seemed, besides their religious observances, was a large playing field with, and this was again new to the Europeans, a rubber ball. There was no rubber in Europe at that time. Balls were made of wood or something similar to that. So this rubber bouncing ball which they played, and this game was central to the Indian idea of hierarchy and social status. The people who did well at it were you know, the Indian version of celebrities. It was a great honor. And so Columbus's men witnessed these games in what was known as a bate, and you know, they left a detailed description of what it was like. And, of course, the rubber fascinated them as well. So bit by bit, they did gain some appreciation of this Taino culture, even as they were snuffing it out. La Isabella was one of the first, if not the first, settlement. It was on the Dominican Republic, on the northern shore of the island of Hispaniola. And it's a park. This is a map from that era. A picture of Cuba. I want to get to more pictures of Isabella to show you. This is what's left of it today. Not too many people go there. It was semi-abandoned when I got there in 2009. This was a cemetery of some of the Spanish soldiers who had populated it for a time until illness claimed them. And this was an idea of what the Europeans were afraid of. I talked about Indians committing suicide. What the Europeans were thinking were that the Indians were fierce cannibals. This was a very popular engraving. Actually, there were a series of hundreds of them by Theodore Debray circulating around Europe, showing Indians greedily devouring human body parts. Here you can see them roasting on a fire, and this spread a frisson of horror throughout Europe. And there were some cannibals around, but the Taino with whom Columbus lived were as afraid of them, perhaps more afraid of them, than the Spanish. The Colombian Exchange. You've been to Papaya King, right? Well, I snapped this picture there. The pineapple was another item that Columbus discovered there and was a great novelty. By the third voyage, you can see he went much further south. And he felt that he was getting close to both paradise and King Solomon's gold mine. So this was the best of both worlds. Off the coast of Venezuela and the Paria Peninsula, he thought he was sailing uphill. Now you can say, how could this master mariner imagine that? And he was becoming more and more delusional as the voyages were going on, even though this was only about 6 years after the first one. And he felt that if he sailed far enough uphill, he would reach the entrance to paradise. and he felt he knew where it was, but he didn't actually want to go there because it wasn't part of his mission. So he didn't actually go there. By the time of the third voyage, it was clear that Columbus, although he was exploring lands that were unknown to Europeans, going down the coast of Central America, some of his men went as far south as the northern coast of Brazil, that he had no idea where he was, and he kept expecting the Chinese to appear at any time, and that the Indians that he found would somehow take him to the Chinese, and that he would finally encounter the people who he was looking for, but of course never found. By the time of the fourth voyage, Columbus was broken in body and spirit. This is a representation of his son Ferdinand in his later years, one of the few, maybe the only one that is around. And Columbus had been replaced. He had made himself so unpopular in Spain. His rivals were ready to pounce. Ferdinand and Isabella had lost interest. There were so many copycat voyages that were going out and getting a jump on him that he had, in effect, been fired. There was a tribunal. He was tried for various crimes, basically corruption, because he was a very poor administrator, and he was guilty of most of these crimes. He was not really tried for cruelty toward the Indians. And this is a little bit like trying Al Capone for income tax evasion instead of for murder. And so it was sort of an analogy to Columbus. And he eventually escaped imprisonment and escaped with his life, but he was not able to get a royal commission to go back to the New World, so he funded it himself. It was a smaller voyage, and that's the one he took along his son. And when he went back to the island he discovered, to Hispaniola, the new ruler, his replacement, wouldn't let him in. Nicolas de Ovando expelled him. And so Columbus instead went to Jamaica, not far away, but he was washed up in dry harbor there in a bad storm. Then he sent for help to Spain or to the Spanish colony in the New World, and no help came, because Nicolas de Ovando didn't want to rescue him. And the Spanish, who were very callous, had lost interest in him. And Columbus kept going, waiting and waiting. He was crippled with arthritis. He was almost blind. His retinas had been scorched by the sun from years of staring at the sea. And he felt the Indians on the island of Jamaica, who had been helping him and his men survive, were getting tired of him too, and were going to attack him. And he thought that he would perish right there on the beach in Jamaica. He managed to pull one last rabbit out of the hat. This is a lunar eclipse when the moon turns red. He saw in his pilot guides that he kept with him that a lunar eclipse was coming on February 29th of 1503, and it was a leap year that year, and he hoped that guide was right. He gathered the Indians together and told them they had been very wicked, and the great spirit in the sky was going to show them how wicked they had been and was going to punish them by turning the moon blood red. And of course, they all scoffed. Now, as you know, a lunar eclipse occurs when the sun and the moon and the earth all line up. And the last one was actually on June 11th of this year. It lasts about an hour and a half or 100 minutes. And it can be very, very striking when the sky is clear. Fortunately for Columbus, the sky was clear that night, and this lunar eclipse was visible all over the Caribbean. The Indians were terrified and regarded him as some sort of sorcerer, not because he accurately predicted it, but because they thought he caused it and that he had supernatural powers. So they became very afraid of him. So they left him alone, and they gave him enough leeway to send a few men on a very hair-raising rescue mission to the Dominican Republic. Finally, Nicolas de Ovando sent some rescue ships to Columbus, not big enough to take all his men. he was just, you know, just as bad as you can imagine. But enough for Columbus and some others to get out of there. And they finally made it back to Spain. Columbus was alive, but barely. Queen Isabella had died. He took refuge in a monastery. Ferdinand came to visit him out of respect, because after all, he was still the admiral of the Ocean Sea, and he was still Christopher Columbus, even though he had been superseded by new explorers. And then Columbus died shortly after that, never realizing the extent that his influence would, his voyages would have on history. You know, an extraordinary and very, very troubling person. He was not particularly celebrated in Spain that time or in Genoa. That came much, much later. He never knew that North America existed. He never set foot anywhere in North America. So Columbus, Ohio, District of Columbus, Columbia River, Columbia University, it's all spurious. He never imagined any of this might have been named in his honor. So the ironies of Columbus and the way that Americans have latched onto him as some sort of forefather, discoverer, or you know, origination myth, something, are really remarkable and shot through with irony. He would never have imagined a nation like this founded in his image. The idea of the Spanish colony that he had founded was a very, very different one. And that's a little bit about what's in my book. There's a lot more. And thank you for your patience in listening to my talk. It's hard to stop talking about Columbus. I appreciate it. Provocative questions, please. Provocative questions. Yes, sir. Forties, yes, old for sailor, yes.
Without a distinguished resume, not only gets an audience with Ferdinand and Isabella,
yes.
Actually starts to dictate terms of
yes.
Contract.
Yes. Part of it was sheer persistence. He had spent 8 years trying to do this in Portugal. And that's a very good question. How did Columbus, with you know, being relatively unknown, get such a spectacular commission from Ferdinand and Isabella? Partly persistence, failing in Portugal, but then gaining a reputation as a contender. So Ferdinand and Isabella commissioned him partly so that Portugal, their rival, wouldn't commission him by that time. And partly because they were taken with his scheme. They didn't invest that much in it. They thought the return could be tremendous. But if he went to sea with those three ships and they all perished, you know, that's life. They were not, they weren't that invested in it until he came back from the first mission. And also he was willing to do something which other people were afraid of, which was to go on a mission like this. So, you know, his courage, his almost foolish courage was singled him out. Yes, sir.
Can I respond to his question?
Sure.
The reason why Columbus was pushed, I mean, was really subsidized, was because of the Inquisition. You know, that was the primary motivating force.
Yes.
That the Jewish chancellors, the conversion chancellors, they were money behind the They supported Columbus because there was a kingdom.
That's interesting. That's an interesting idea. Yeah.
In fact, that's one of the best things. People think all of us was Jewish. I believe that.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's enough evidence to do that.
Yeah.
All you got to do is just look at the day he said, so you know, then this was people. His sailors thought he was Jewish.
Yes.
You know, he never spoke a single word of Italian or Genoese. I don't think he understood that. He spoke Catalan, which was spoken by converted Jews in Italian.
Well, you see, there are many different Columbuses, and in fact, he did write in Spanish, and well, for you. Anyway, okay, any other questions? More controversial, the better. Yes, ma'am. Oh, some descriptions from that era portray him that way. They may have been romanticized, but and also tradition alleges that he was had red hair. Yes, sir. Oh, the Windward Islands and the Bahamas, going further south to the Pariah Peninsula of Venezuela, along the coast of Venezuela, Nicaragua, Panama, sailing further down some of those coastal islands as well. Columbus would often mention tantalizingly that he'd sailed past hundreds or dozens of islands without specifically naming them. That's why that map I showed you by Juan de la Cosa is valuable, because it gives some sense of, you know, where they might have been. But trying to guess exactly where Columbus is difficult. There are 6 or even 8 islands that are contenders for his first landfall in the New World, for example.
Yeah, that wasn't the question. The question is, besides
yes.
Hispaniola,
right.
Oh,
yes.
Permanent settlements.
Yeah. No, Hispaniola was the focus of his empire. Yeah, that was the...
Hispaniola, they did voyages on the Caribbean coast of South America.
That was their base of operations. Hispaniola became their focus on the Ozama River. Yes, sir. Yes.
Isn't it true that when he came back from his first and second voyage, so he started some excitement back in Europe that caused others to
yes.
make the
yes.
world
yes.
So in essence,
but,
he did play an important role.
Well, he was a catalyst. For sure he was a catalyst. But he never guessed that North America existed himself. Yes. Yes.
Going to New York, that would have been down to Hispaniola. And also, are there any theories about why he became delusional?
The first question was about currents. You mean trade winds? Yeah, Columbus's great and inadvertent discovery on the first voyage was the existence of the trade winds. And that's why he was able to sail across the Atlantic so quickly and relatively safely, faster than he expected. He was able to traverse the Atlantic in 23 or 25 days. And even now, somebody going under sail, no power, would be hard-pressed to best that record.
It
took him south, yes. Yes, yeah, so he just kept going. It was very simple. He kept going until he hit the first landmass that he saw and decided that, well, this must be China. And so his ideas of navigation were simple. He was much better with point-to-point navigation. The second question was... Oh, you know, it's very difficult to speculate about psychology over the centuries like that. But he did. You know, it was an era of strong religious fervor, so he was not that unusual compared to other people of that era. But he was certainly much more devout than other explorers. Although Magellan was nearly as devout as Magellan, but as Columbus, but not to the point of having these, hallucinations. Columbus even thought he heard the voice of God speaking to him on one of the later voyages, and wrote down what he thought God said. So we get, you know, a vivid sense of Columbus's inner life. He was spoken Spanish, of course. Or maybe it was Genoese. Yes.
Oh.
No. Everybody knew it was round by then. Any sailor who set out from a harbor and saw, or just stood out of harbor and saw a ship sink below the horizon, realized that the earth was round. No, they weren't criminals. They were basically what you call freebooters, or that they weren't pirates then. This was before pirates, but they would have been pirates if they could have been pirates. They were people who were just, they were going to the New World to get rich quick. And they were basically lawless. They were mostly Spanish. Magellan actually had a more difficult time rounding up a crew. And he did have a lot of criminals who came right out of jail into his ships. Yes, they were volunteers. Some of them were professional seamen, but you know, their idea of professional and ours would be drastically different. There were professional pilots, professional navigators. Columbus, compared to them, was highly professional.
So when he ran into that trouble, he had some mutinies, though, right?
Yes, he had mutinies all the time. It's hard to generalize. All these mutinies had different characters. I write about them in the book. Some were not serious mutinies. They were sort of grumbling and discontent. Some were actually rebellions on land that lasted for several years. They were splinter groups that formed. There was Francisco Roldan, who I write about at some length, who challenged Columbus as a rival in the New World. But mutinies were part of a explorer's lot. Columbus wasn't the only one who faced mutinies, and violently putting down mutinies, which Columbus did on occasion, was also part of the explorer profile. Yes, ma'am.
I've been reading in the paper about both Columbus and Vasco da Gama that supposedly they wanted money, being that Columbus was so devout,
yeah,
that they could wage war against the Muslims and get back the Holy Land.
Right. That was one of the ideas that he fed to Ferdinand Isabel. This was the time of the Inquisition. The unification of Spain had just occurred, and so that was part of the rationale that Columbus advanced. He never really brought back enough gold to do that, but he was hoping that he would, and Ferdinand Isabella thought that would have been wonderful if he had. What he did send back that was unexpected were slaves. Interestingly, Ferdinand and Isabella didn't want them and sent them back to the New World, not because they were such great humanitarians, but because they had just finished the Inquisition. They had pushed outsiders off the Iberian Peninsula, and they didn't want a whole new group of outsiders coming in. So they sent them back and told Columbus, essentially, convert them. Don't enslave them. Columbus was sort of bewildered by this. He thought he had sent them a great gift. Why was he so enthusiastic about, I forgot to mention this, about slavery, even when his sovereigns weren't? In Genoa, slavery was common. Most families who could afford it had slaves. So Columbus grew up with slavery as part of his life. Slaves in Genoa were often from Eastern Europe. The women were often concubines, and men often had separate households right in Genoa. So for Columbus, the idea of slavery, maybe we'd think of it more like indentured servitude, wasn't that unusual. In fact, it was something that he grew up with. Any other? Yes, ma'am. It begins, it's interesting, it begins in France, actually. They were the first nation to actually portray Columbus in heroic, larger-than-life figures and to echo some of Columbus's own sense of destiny, that he was destined by God to do this. That's what he thought he heard God telling him to do. The French caught that spirit. And in the United States, as Italian immigrants came to the United States, societies and groups and politicians in some ways kind of played on the heroic image of Columbus to appeal to Italian Americans as voters. Columbus Day was only became a federal holiday in this country in 1937. when FDR established it to attract the Italian-American vote. So it was done out of political expedience. That's how recent it is. Now, there had been Columbus Day observances in the United States going back to 1890 to the 1890s, but that was really the first mention that we have of them. The Columbia Exposition was an effort by Chicago to, you know, embrace Columbus as some kind of a founder, because there really wasn't anybody. But interestingly enough, it was meant to observe the 400th anniversary. It opened a year late. They didn't get it finished in time. So it was 1493. In some ways, that put Columbus, or gave Columbus, a special role that he hadn't had before. But it was FDR, I think, who really set the seal on it. Well, you know, if we had a Viking exchange, if the Vikings had left Vikings here, if the Vikings had brought, you know, it would have been different. You know, Columbus, you know, really left a more than a thumbprint, a you know, huge footprint on the New World that no other group did before him. So. Anyway, I think we're getting near the end. So thank you, Mark.
I'd like to thank you all for coming and encourage you to pick up a copy of the book. It's for sale outside. Our friends from the Corner Bookstore are here, and Larry will be here at the front of the members' room, so just line up around the back wall, and he'll be happy to sign your copy. Thanks for coming. He'll be right here.